Chapter 14 of the Benson Murder Case by S.S. Van Dyne. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for non-commercial purposes, as long as Legamus is credited and any new creation is licensed under the same terms. Read by Kathy Barrett. Chapter 14. Links in the Chain. Monday, June 17, 6 p.m. Vance and I spent an hour or so that afternoon at the Anderson Galleries looking at some tapestries which were to be auctioned the next day, and afterward had tea at Sherry's. We were at the Stuyvesant Club a little before six. A few minutes later, Markham and Fife arrived, and we went at once into one of the conference rooms. Fife was as elegant and superior as at the first interview. He wore a rat-catcher suit and Newmarket gaiters of unbleached linen, and was redolent of perfume. "An unexpected pleasure to see you gentlemen again so soon," he greeted us, like one conferring a blessing. Markham was far from amiable, and gave him an almost brusque salutation. Vance had merely nodded, and now sat regarding Fife drearily, as if seeking to find some excuse for his existence, but utterly unable to do so. Markham went directly to the point. "I've found out, Mr. Fife, that you placed your machine in a garage at noon on Friday, and gave the man $20 to say nothing about it." Fife looked up with a hurt look. "I've been deeply wronged," he complained sadly. "I gave the man $50. "I am glad you admit the fact so readily," returned Markham. "You knew by the newspapers, of course, that your machine was seen outside Benson's house the night he was shot." "Why else should I have paid so liberally to have its presence in New York kept secret?" His tone indicated that he was pained at the other's obtuseness. "In that case, why did you keep it in the city at all?" asked Markham. "You could have driven it back to Long Island." Fife shook his head sorrowfully, a look of commiseration in his eyes. Then he leaned forward with an air of benign patience. He would be gentle with this dull-witted district attorney, like a fond teacher with a backward child, and would strive to lead him out of the tangle of his uncertainties. "I am a married man, Mr. Markham." He pronounced the fact as if some special virtue attached to it. "I started on my trip for the Catskills Thursday after dinner, intending to stop a day in New York to make my adieus to someone residing here. I arrived quite late, after midnight, and decided to call on Alvin. But when I drove up, the house was dark. So without even ringing the bell, I walked to Pietro's in 43rd Street to get a nightcap. I keep a bit of my own pinch bottle Hag and Hag there. But alas, the place was closed, and I strolled back to my car. To think that while I was away, poor Alvin was shot." He stopped and polished his eyeglass. "The irony of it! I didn't even guess that anything had happened to the dear fellow. How could I? I drove, all unsuspecting of the tragedy, to a Turkish bath and remained there the night. The next morning I read of the murder, and in the later editions I saw the mention of my car. It was then I became, shall I say, worried? But no, worried is a misleading word. Let me say, rather, that I became aware of the false position I might be placed in if the car were traced to me. So I drove it to the garage and paid the man to say nothing of its whereabouts, lest its discovery confuse the issue of Alvin's death." One might have thought, from his tone and the self-righteous way he looked at Markham, that he had bribed the garageman wholly out of consideration for the district attorney and the police. "Why didn't you continue on your trip?" asked Markham. "That would have made the discovery of the car even less likely." Fife adopted an air of compassionate surprise. "With my dearest friend foully murdered? How could one have the heart to seek diversion at such a sad moment? I returned home and informed Mrs. Fife that my car had broken down." "You might have driven home in your car, it seems to me," observed Markham. Fife offered a look of infinite forbearance for the other's inspection, and took a deep sigh, which conveyed the impression that, though he could not sharpen the world's perceptions, he at least could mourn for its deplorable lack of understanding. "If I had been in the Catskills away from any source of information where Mrs. Fife believed me to be, how would I have heard of Alvin's death until, perhaps, days afterward? You see, unfortunately, I had not mentioned to Mrs. Fife that I was stopping over in New York. The truth is, Mr. Markham, I had reason for not wishing my wife to know I was in the city. Consequently, if I had driven back at once, she would, I regret to say, have suspected me of breaking my journey. I therefore pursued the course which seemed simplest." Markham was becoming annoyed at the man's fluent hypocrisy. After a brief silence, he asked abruptly, "Did the presence of your car at Benson's house that night have anything to do with your apparent desire to implicate Captain Leacock in the affair?" Fife lifted his eyebrows in pained astonishment, and made a gesture of polite protestation.
"My dear sir!"
His voice betokened profound resentment of the other's unjust imputation. "If yesterday you detected in my words an undercurrent of suspicion against Captain Leacock, I can account for it only by the fact that I actually saw the captain in front of Alvin's house when I drove up that night." Markham shot a curious look at Vance, then said to Fife, "You are sure you saw Leacock?" "I saw him quite distinctly, and I would have mentioned the fact yesterday had it not involved the tacit confession of my own presence there."
"What if it had?" demanded Markham. "It was vital information, and I could have used it this morning. You are placing your comfort ahead of the legal demands of justice, and your attitude puts a very questionable aspect on your own alleged conduct that night."
"You are pleased to be severe, sir," said Fife with self-pity, "but having placed myself in a false position, I must accept your criticism."
"Do you realize," Markham went on, "that many a district attorney, if he knew what I know about your movements and had been treated the way you've treated me, would arrest you on suspicion?"
"Then I can only say," was the suave response, "that I am most fortunate in my inquisitor."
Markham rose.
"That will be all for today, Mr. Fife. But you are to remain in New York until I give you permission to return home. Otherwise, I will have you held as a material witness."
Fife made a shocked gesture in deprecation of such acerbities and bade us a ceremonious good afternoon. When we were alone, Markham looked seriously at Vance. "Your prophecy was fulfilled, though I didn't dare hope for such luck. Fife's evidence puts the final link in the chain against the captain."
Vance smoked languidly.
"I'll admit your theory of the crime is most satisfying, but alas, the psychological objection remains. Everything fits, with the one exception of the captain, and he doesn't fit at all. Silly idea, I know, but he has no more business being cast as the murderer of Benson than the Bessonic Tetrazzini had being cast as the phthisical Mimi."
Note, obviously a reference to Tetrazzini's performance in La Bohème at the Manhattan Opera House in 1908.
"In any other circumstances," Markham answered, "I might defer reverently to your charming theories, but with all the circumstantial and presumptive evidence I have against Leacock, it strikes my inferior legal mind as sheer nonsense to say he just couldn't be guilty because his hair is parted in the middle and he tucks his napkin in his collar. There's too much logic against it."
"I'll grant your logic is irrefutable, as all logic is, no doubt. You've probably convinced many innocent persons by sheer reasoning that they were guilty."
Vance stretched himself wearily.
"What do you say to a light repast on the roof? The unutterable Fife has tired me."
In the summer dining-room on the roof of the Stuyvesant Club, we found Major Benson sitting alone, and Markham asked him to join us.
"I have good news for you, Major," he said when we had given our order. "I feel confident I have my man. Everything points to him. Tomorrow we'll see the end, I hope."
The Major gave Markham a questioning frown.
"I don't understand exactly. From what you told me the other day, I got the impression there was a woman involved."
Markham smiled awkwardly and avoided Vance's eyes.
"A lot of water has run under the bridge since then," he said. "The woman I had in mind was eliminated as soon as we began to check up on her. But in the process I was led to the man. There's little doubt of his guilt. I felt pretty sure about it this morning, and just now I learned that he was seen by a credible witness in front of your brother's house within a few minutes of the time the shot was fired."
"Is there any objection to your telling me who it was?" The Major was still frowning.
"None whatsoever. The whole city will probably know it tomorrow. It was Captain Leacock."
Major Benson stared at him in unbelief.
"Impossible! I simply can't credit it. That boy was with me 3 years on the other side, and I got to know him pretty well. I can't help feeling there's a mistake somewhere. The police," he added quickly, "have got on the wrong track."
"It's not the police," Markham informed him. "It was my own investigations that turned up the captain." The Major did not answer, but his silence bespoke his doubt.
"You know," put in Vance, "I feel the same way about the captain that you do, Major. It rather pleases me to have my impressions verified by one who has known him so long."
"What, then, was Leacock doing in front of the house that night?" urged Markham assiduously.
"He might have been singing carols beneath Benson's window," suggested Vance.
Before Markham could reply, he was handed a card by the head waiter. When he glanced at it, he gave a grunt of satisfaction and directed that the caller be sent up immediately. Then, turning back to us, he said, "We may learn something more now. I've been expecting this man Higginbotham. He's the detective that followed Leacock from my office this morning." Higginbotham was a wiry, pale-faced youth with fishy eyes and a shifty manner. He slouched up to the table and stood hesitantly before the district attorney. "Sit down and report, Higginbotham," Markham ordered. "These gentlemen are working with me on the case." "I picked up the bird while he was waiting for the elevator," the man began, eyeing Markham craftily. "He went to the subway and rode uptown to 79th and Broadway. He walked through 80th to Riverside Drive and went in the apartment house at number 94. Didn't give his name to the boy, got right in the elevator. He stayed upstairs a couple hours, come down at 1:20 and hopped a taxi. I picked up another one and followed him. He went down the drive to 72nd, through Central Park, and east on 59th. Got out at Avenue A and walked out on the Queensborough Bridge. About halfway to Blackswell's Island, he stood leaning over the rail for 5 or 6 minutes. Then he took a small package out of his pocket and dropped it in the river." "What size was this package?" There was repressed eagerness in Markham's question. Higginbotham indicated the measurements with his hands. "How thick was it?"
"Inch or so, maybe."
Markham leaned forward.
"Could it have been a gun, a Colt automatic?"
"Sure it could, just about the right size. And it was heavy, too. I could tell by the way he handled it and the way it hit the water."
"All right." Markham was pleased. "Anything else?"
"No, sir. After he ditched the gun, he went home and stayed. I left him there."
When Higginbotham had gone, Markham nodded at Vance with melancholy elation.
"There's your criminal agent. What more would you like?"
"Oh, lots," drawled Vance.
Major Benson looked up, perplexed.
"I don't quite grasp the situation. Why did Leacock have to go to Riverside Drive for his gun?"
"I have reason to think," said Markham, "that he took it to Miss St. Clair the day after the shooting, for safe-keeping, probably. He wouldn't have wanted it found in his place."
"Might he not have taken it to Miss St. Clair's before the shooting?"
"I know what you mean," Markham answered. "I, too, recalled the major's assertion the day before that Miss St. Clair was more capable of shooting his brother than was the captain.
I had the same idea myself, but certain evidential facts have eliminated her as a suspect."
"You've undoubtedly satisfied yourself on the point," returned the major, but his tone was dubious. "However, I can't see Leacock as Alvin's murderer."
He paused and laid a hand on the district attorney's arm.
"I don't want to appear presumptuous or unappreciative of all you've done, but I really wish you'd wait a bit before clapping that boy into prison. The most careful and conscientious of us are liable to error. Even facts sometimes lie damnably, and I can't help believing that the facts in this instance have deceived you."
It was plain that Markham was touched by this request of his old friend, but his instinctive fidelity to duty helped him to resist the other's appeal.
"I must act according to my convictions, Major," he said firmly, but with a great kindness.
End of chapter 14.